Chapter 1. The elephant on her chest made it difficult to breathe. From her position on her living room's plush oversized couch, her laptop balanced on the crook of her leg, Abby Carlson felt that familiar tightness press upon her as it often did during times like this, expected conversations about her childhood. It had been 2 months since the elephant had made its last appearance, when she'd been notified about her stepfather. Brain cancer. 3 months, maybe 6 with treatment. Abby had handled the news well enough, telling herself that although her plan to finally visit him in prison and confront him about what he'd done to her as a little girl would now be expedited, it needn't be immediate. But all that had changed 2 days ago when she'd heard that the 3 to 6 months he had left was now mere weeks, if not days. More tumors had been found. Soon, his cognition would be severely reduced, followed by unconsciousness, then the end quickly thereafter. She'd had 5 years and every opportunity to visit him, but here she was, about to speak with her counselor over Zoom instead of heading to the prison, because rushing something like this didn't just bring the elephant back, it invited the whole herd. Her computer clock read 4:29 p.m. The virtual therapy sessions she'd scheduled 2 days ago would start in another minute. Her cat, Thomas Magnum, lay curled beside her on the couch, oblivious to his master's growing anxiety. A familiar mix of sadness and happiness came to Abby when she settled her gaze on him. Sadness that the tabby she'd adopted from the local cat cafe would never get the chance to experience human emotion, and happiness for the same reason. When the clock turned to 4:30, she exhaled a deep sigh, then moved the cursor over the Connect tab and clicked on it. The throbber whirled for several seconds before the connection was made. Then her screen changed to the live camera image of a smallish man seated in a wheelchair behind a desk. She'd chosen the man on purpose. Not so much due to his gender or Abby's self-professed reluctance to spill her guts to another woman, but because the man's profile had included a photo of his undersized body hunched over in a wheelchair, his equally undersized head twisting upward in what appeared to be a painful attempt to face the camera. If Abby was going to endure emotional pain, she figured the counselor she would choose might have more sympathy for her if he was enduring some physical pain of his own. While making sense to her, the thought had made her feel guilty at the same time, which was even worse now as she sat watching him shift uncomfortably in his electric wheelchair. His underdeveloped arms lay like a child's on the chair's armrests. The dark blanket he wore like a shawl couldn't hide the melon-sized hump on his right shoulder. In college, Abby had known someone with a similar-looking disability. The woman had been prone to getting cold, even in warm months, and had always worn a blanket. Abby eyed the counselor's pale complexion and guessed he didn't see much sunlight. No surprise there. Other than his obvious disability, he had the expected counselor appearance. Readers perched low on his nose, an Oxford sweater vest combo, and a wisp of gray hair swept across his balding head. "Good afternoon, Miss Carlson," he said, his voice surprisingly deep for his size.
"Good afternoon to you, sir,"
Abby said, managing a smile. He waved one of his smallish hands. "Please, no sirs around here. Call me Harlan."
"Okay, and you can call me Abby. It's Abigail, technically, but only my mother called me that."
"Abby it is." They locked eyes through their camera connections momentarily, an awkward silence filling the net-provided space between them, until Harlan shifted in his wheelchair and said something that surprised her. "Before we begin, I'd like to disclose something about myself. I am by no means required to discuss it with patients, but I choose to anyway, since it tends to clear the air and offer some perspective." He motioned toward his child-sized, twisted body, no more than 3 feet long from head to foot and barely 50 pounds from the look of him. "I was born with an obvious birth defect that, well, can be disquieting to some people. I've even been compared to a hunchback." He indicated his disproportionately sized upper back and the sizable hump on his right shoulder under the blanket. Congenital scoliosis gave me this hump, and microcephaly gave me my head and limbs. He manipulated a control on the chair's armrest and reversed the chair away from the desk to quickly reveal parts of his undersized legs. The blanket lay bunched around them and fell to the floor. He shivered, then touched a control and moved the chair back to where it had been. The doctors said the odds of a child having both these conditions is 1 in several million, he said. The odds of that child surviving to adolescence is even rarer. But others are much less fortunate than me, so I try not to complain. He smiled and pushed up the glasses on his nose.
It must be difficult for you going out in public,
Abby said, surprised the session was beginning with her expressing empathy for the man who was supposed to be showing it to her. It was much more difficult as a child, emotionally speaking. My condition has worsened as I've aged, but it's something I've learned to live with. On a slightly different subject, have you heard of the fictional character Quasimodo?
Wasn't he the Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Yes, the counselor said, his face lighting up. Most people don't know that. He happens to be my favorite fictional character, so I take it as a compliment when someone calls me that. His smile broadened as he reached forward as far as he could and rotated his laptop 90 degrees to show a large bookcase against the wall. He zoomed the camera shot for her to read the titles more easily. There it is on the top shelf, in the middle. Quite a read, if you have the time. I feel that I've always shared a commonality with Hugo, he said off camera. Abby stared at the book, wide-eyed.
Talk about a doorstop.
The counselor laughed and rotated the laptop back to face him, adjusting the zoom back to normal. Indeed. Publishers balk at longer works these days. I mention it to give you an example of taking something good from a bad situation. From an early age, I knew that I would never play sports or even take a single step on my own. Instead of self-pity, I directed my life toward doing this. He spread his hands and looked around the office before settling his gaze back onto his computer screen. He appeared to be reading something off of it. Let's see. Your written application states you're 31, single, and that you wish to focus on your childhood sexual abuse, correct?
Yes.
Specifically, you're wanting to speak to your abuser before he is expected to pass away soon? Abby's stomach fluttered.
Yes. I guess I need some advice on how to handle it.
Okay. We'll begin in a moment, and no worries. We'll still have our full hour once we get through these formalities. Before we start, I wanted to let you know that I like to challenge my clients to accept their past and understand that although they cannot change it, it makes them who they are today. Like Quasimodo, we must all look past our ugliness and find contentedness. For him, it was looking down on Paris from the tower and ringing the bell. The question is, where will you find yours? Abby, taken in by the man's surprising insight, felt her previous anxiousness begin to melt away. She was already feeling her body relax into the couch's plushness.
I'll try my best.
They began where he suggested, her childhood. After describing her earliest years, which had been filled with mostly pleasant, albeit fleeting, memories of both her birth parents, she moved on to the years following her father's sudden death and her mother's second marriage. Immediately, the mood of the conversation changed. She took a breath and let the information come out without trying to sugarcoat it.
He molested me, my stepfather, from age 6 to about 10. It started with touching, then progressed into other things. It happened a long time ago, but sometimes it feels like yesterday, if that makes any sense.
She looked into the man's eyes.
It's weird, but sometimes I feel like it happened to someone else.
A curious expression passed before the counselor's eyes. Abby noticed it and wondered if it had been caused by a fleeting personal memory, perhaps. It's common for victims of abuse to become disassociated from their trauma. I encourage you to treat your child self and adult self like travelers on a long voyage. You will never be the same person once you reach each signpost in life, because each experience and every person you meet along the way will imprint upon you. Make sense?
I guess,
she said. She turned to gaze out her living room window onto Lindale Avenue, two stories below. The busy uptown thoroughfare was especially so today, with weekday rush hour traffic clogging the street and pedestrians strolling along the sidewalk. Separating her hands and shoving them beneath her thighs, Abby shifted her gaze back onto the counselor.
Part of me hates myself for not resisting him more. It wouldn't have stopped him, but it's always made me feel like a coward for not trying anyway.
The counselor's eyebrows arched from behind his glasses. That's a common feeling for people in your position. As for when you plan to visit him in prison and speak with him about the abuse, I'm assuming that's why he's there.
He only has a few weeks to live at most. I have a visit scheduled for Monday, but he might not be in any condition to talk. And no, he's there for dealing drugs. He'll never serve a day for what he did to me.
The counselor nodded. I see. What do you plan on saying to him? She prepared to say something she'd thought of many times before, a line that said if what had happened to her had taught her anything, it was that she'd die fighting rather than be subjected to anything like that again, to prove that he hadn't truly defeated her. But instead of that, she said something that surprised her.
I'd tell him I feel sorry for him. It must have been agonizing waking up every day, wondering if that would be the day my mom found out.
Did she?
No, I never told.
What do you think she would have done if you had? Abby huffed.
She would have waited until he passed out, then poured gasoline on him and lit it, like the movie, The Burning Bed.
And now that you're an adult? Abby shrugged.
I'll never know. She died 2 years ago, a year after my brother was killed in a car accident.
I'm very sorry for your losses. But what if I told you that you could tell her, your stepfather too, right now, as you sit there on your couch during this meeting? She frowned.
You mean using a Ouija board or something?
No. I mean that just because someone is dead or locked away in prison doesn't mean you can't tell them how you feel. Communication doesn't always necessitate a tacit response from the respondent. Preferable, yes, but not mandatory.
Okay, she began. So, how do I do this?
Turn and speak to them as if they were sitting beside you. But before you do, know that if it's your stepfather, he has no ability to harm you. In fact, he won't have the ability to touch you or even speak. You're in control. Say your piece, anything you want, no matter how angry or vile or unforgiving it may be. She bit her lip, then turned sharply on the couch, propping her knee onto the cushion and folding her arms across her chest.
Hank, I've wanted to tell you this ever since I was little. You did those things to me, knowing I'd never tell. That makes you a pedophile and a coward. Just know that I feel sorry for you. It must have been agonizing for you to wake every day and wonder if that'd be the day my mom would find out. She would have killed you. Horribly. Then she would have gone to prison. That's the real reason I never told. Because even though you stole my innocence, I refused to have it affect my mom, too.
Her breathing was coming shorter now, and her heart was pounding in her chest. But she felt better already, empowered. She made a satisfied sound before turning back toward Harlan's image on her laptop screen.
Wow,
He gave a knowing nod. The best part of this exercise is that you get to do it whenever you need to.
And every time he can't speak or touch me.
That's how it works. She did the same for her mother, telling her how happy she was her mother had lived her life free from the prison she surely would have experienced. And that despite that gratefulness, Abby wished she'd been somehow able to communicate to her what had happened. When she was done, she turned her gaze back out the same window and brushed aside a single tear. She'd expected more of them, but then again, she'd shed enough during her life to fill a river. Not wishing to dwell on the past, she concentrated on the bustling uptown thoroughfare below. Early November in Minneapolis had brought with it the first frost of the season, as well as an explosion of reds and yellows from the maple trees lining the street. During the second half hour of the session, they spoke of varying topics. Included in them was talk of her most recent boyfriend, Anson, whom she'd broken up with 2 months ago. They'd dated for a year, their breakup due to them having grown apart. "Do you know where he is now?" Harlan asked.
"He lives right down the street,"
she said, her face a picture of resigned irony.
"A mutual friend told me he's dating a girl I went to college with. I'm happy for him."
"Anyone since then?"
"No. I'm sure I will when I meet someone right for me."
At the end of the session, Harlan suggested, "How about we end with a pleasant childhood memory? Keep it brief." Her brow wrinkled in thought.
"My grandparents' farm. I spent a few weeks there every summer. One of my favorite things to do was walking through a large field of wildflowers. I'd walk with my hands at my sides, letting the flowers pass over my palms. I remember thinking that if I could only release all my pain and shame into them, I'd feel better. That it'd make what was happening to me easier to deal with. But the idea of giving those beautiful flowers something so ugly, so vile, disgusted me. I would have never forgiven myself. So I kept it from them. That always made me happy, knowing they'd stay pretty and innocent."
Abby uttered a contented sound as she turned her attention back onto the counselor. He seemed to be in his own thoughts while at the same time appearing to have listened closely to her. She felt a sudden wave of gratefulness for having picked the man out of the dozens of potential counselors, even though her initial reasons had been selfish. "That was a brave thing that little girl did, saving those flowers," Harlan said. He adjusted his position in the wheelchair, his smallish head stooped even lower than before. Eyeing his hunched back and hump on his shoulder, Abby wished she could somehow reach through the screen and hug him.
"I think I locked the memories away and only realized they were still there when I found out he was dying of cancer. I'm still going to visit him next week, but this really helped. Thank you."
"Good," he said. "Like I said, use this method whenever you feel the need. Think of it as your weaker self hypnotizing your stronger self. I do it all the time." He smiled. "Seems we've run out of time. Would you like to schedule another session?" She nodded.
"I'd like that."
She reached for the box of tissues she'd placed beside her and used one to blot her eyes. "Well then," she could see him reading something off his screen again. "How about next Wednesday, same time? That'll give you time to conduct your visit and let it settle."
"That works."
She went to end the session when she paused.
"Would it be improper if I asked you a personal question?"
The counselor shrugged. "Not unless you're going to ask me if I ate an entire pint of Ben and Jerry's last night." They both laughed.
"Do you ever wonder what it would be like, walking on your own?"
As soon as the words left her mouth, she regretted them. They sounded horridly rude, even to her own ears. Clearly, she'd overstepped. Instead of looking offended or becoming defensive, however, he smiled. "Every day. And no, that wasn't too personal. I'm glad to share it." She sighed. The elephant, she realized for the first time, had risen off her chest.
See you next Wednesday,
she said, and pressed end session. After feeding Thomas Magnum and changing from her work scrubs into stylish jeans and a new sweater she'd bought at her favorite consignment store the week before, Abby grabbed the small gift off the counter she'd wrapped earlier that morning. Riding the elevator to her apartment building's lobby, she approached the doorman who was opening the door for her. "Evening, missy," he said, removing his billed cap to reveal a wisp of thinning white hair.
"Good evening yourself, Harold,"
Abby said, trying her best to mimic his formal air. She held out the package for him.
"For Marna. Sorry to miss her birthday last week. I was swamped at work."
Harold's smile wrinkled the corners of his eyes. "Well now, you don't have to do that."
"I sure did,"
she said, motioning for him to take the gift.
"She remembered mine. Besides, I'm sure she's been a bit down after the surgery. How is she?"
He accepted the gift and slipped it into his doorman coat's inner pocket. "She's been better. The doctors say they got it all, but you never know," he grimaced. "Hard for a woman to lose her parts up there, even at her age." Abby touched his arm.
"I can imagine. Tell her I'll come visit this weekend when I'm off. We can watch Hallmark movies and bake cookies."
Harold laughed. "I may pass on the movies a bit, but I'll take a few of those cookies," he winked. "Come over whenever." She squeezed his arm, then went across the threshold when he stuck his arm out to stop her. "You be careful out here, missy," he said in a low voice. He looked toward both directions of the street. "He's out here, plucking 'em right and left. Took that nurse from the hospital up the way, the rapper girl, too, just last week. Finished her concert down at Club First Avenue, then poof, gone out of thin air." He made an exploding hand gesture, his eyes widening as he did. Abby smiled confidently.
"I'm the last woman a kidnapper would be interested in. The most exciting part about me is coming home from work to watch Wheel of Fortune with my cat. But I promise I'll be careful."
She stepped through the doorway and turned left down the sidewalk toward the bar that was her destination. As she walked past familiar neighborhood shops and apartment buildings, she forced away thoughts of the serial kidnapper. 2 dozen women since the previous spring, each one's profession represented by a different letter of the alphabet, and all abducted from their place of business. The police had witnesses and fingerprints, even surveillance video, but had yet to find the suspect. He'd had an accomplice on several occasions who had yet to be found either. Just like everyone else in the city and across the nation, Abby had initially been alarmed by the brazenness of the crimes. Since he'd preyed on local women in their 20s and 30s, Abby and other women in that demographic had had much more to worry about. But like many noteworthy crimes or traumatic news events, people tended to push the continual news flashes into the backs of their minds. As fantastic as those flashes were, people had lives to live. Abby was no different. As she now walked down the busy uptown street, the late autumn sun just dipping below the horizon, she replaced thoughts of kidnappers and redundant news articles with those of the therapy session she'd just had. Now that was newsworthy to her. Long dormant memories of her childhood had been disturbed, like a broom raising dust from a forgotten corner. She'd gone into the session hopeful she could come to grips with the possibility she may never get the chance to confront her stepfather. She'd finished it feeling as confident as she could. But now, as she fought to push the dust cloud of memories back into its rightful corner, she decided she still needed that final bit of closure. Talking to the counselor had done what she'd intended, prepare her for Monday's visit at the prison. She'd preferred to go earlier, but the prison medical department had ruled it out due to her stepfather's recent procedure. It was a bitter irony that the man who had abused her for a large part of her childhood was now someone she hoped would survive through the weekend. 10 minutes later, she walked through the front door of the Gimlet, the swanky uptown bar. She'd only been here once, a brief visit about a year ago during a bar crawl with friends. Now, after exchanging polite smiles with the hostess, Abby stepped into the main sitting area and scanned the collections of heads. She didn't see Derek, her platonic male best friend. When she scanned the room again and still didn't see him, she checked her phone on the chance he'd canceled last minute. No missed calls or messages from him. She took a lap around the bustling place, deftly dodging a woman in a cocktail dress and high heels carrying an extremely full martini. Still nothing. Derek must have gotten delayed at the shop, she figured. Turning back toward the front door to call him outside, she'd just taken two steps when she heard her name called out from her left. Looking in that direction, she saw the top of a bald African-American man's head and a waving arm from atop a row of potted plants. Weaving her way through crowded tables, she made her way to where he sat.
"Sorry I'm late. I got held up at the bank,"
she said, opting for a white lie instead of having to rehash her therapy session. She plopped onto the chair opposite him, took a sip from the glass of water already there, and gave a huge sigh.
"You were in a bank robbery?"
Derek asked, eyes wide. He raised both hands with feigned melodrama and looked at an imaginary person beside him.
"Excuse me, Mr. Robber. If you're looking for someone to strip naked and tie up, I volunteer."
Abby nearly spit out a mouthful of water.
"You're terrible,"
she said, flagging down their waiter. She ordered them both a Cosmo, keeping with their hump day happy hour tradition. They made small talk for several minutes, during which she tried in vain to fully suppress thoughts of her therapy session. When their drinks came, she took a sip of hers and instantly felt warmth spread through her. The heaviness in her chest that had been present before and during the session had faded once the session ended. But now, as she smiled into her best friend's face, she felt guilty for telling him even a white lie. He must have seen it in her eyes because he laid a hand on hers and asked,
"Honey, you okay?"
"I'll be fine,"
she said, relieved he'd asked.
"My bank visit was really the counseling session I mentioned."
Derek nodded knowingly.
"How'd it go?"
She took a huge gulp of her drink, set the glass down, and stared at it.
"Say no more,"
Derek said, squeezing her hand.
"Charles has been seeing a therapist ever since we've been together. I'm starting to believe that some skeletons are meant to stay buried." "At least I didn't have to talk face to face. I found someone who does Zoom sessions."
"Oh, I love Zoom.
It's how Charles and I met. It's amazing how much of a connection you can have with someone through a computer screen. I've thought about developing a Zoom dating site called Lear the Queer."
Abby laughed.
"I'm sure it'd be a hit, knowing your business skills. You may even give Grindr a run for their money."
Suddenly, Derek's expression turned serious.
"Oh my God, you just reminded me. Did you hear about the new Instagram post? They think it's him again."
"Him who?" Abby asked. Derek gave her an exasperated look.
"PK, who else? We were just talking about Naughty Nice yesterday. The cops got the post taken down right away, but everyone's saying it's him."
Abby nodded.
"My doorman just reminded me about it. Everyone thought it was going to be a real estate agent or something exotic, like a race car driver." "I don't know how much more exotic you can get than a rap star with a diamond-studded microphone,"
Derek said.
"Her bodyguard went on the news saying he watched her walk into her dressing room alone after her concert ended. When he checked on her, 5 minutes later, she was gone." "I thought the cops said they got camera footage of the suspect,"
Abby said, indulging Derek's need to gossip, even if it now involved discussing the criminal the media had dubbed the profession killer.
"They did, but it was inconclusive. Until we found out it was PK, everyone at the shop joked that maybe she got tired of all the fame and disappeared to the same island Biggie and Tupac went to."
They both laughed.
"But seriously, aren't you worried?"
Abby frowned.
"Why would I be worried?"
"Because you're a D.
Only that and V left."
She went to say something along the lines of him being ridiculous, that it was foolish to be worried about being one of dozens of potential professions and thousands of women whom the serial kidnapper could target, but even saying that seemed like wasted utility.
"Derek, I appreciate your thoughts,
but I have more to worry about than some weirdo who poses dead women in their work clothes. I'm a dietitian. We're boring. Mine is the last profession he'd target. True. Maybe he'll take a dancer.
Abby shook her head.
He already has the stripper. It's the same thing. At least he's equal opportunity.
She felt warm all of a sudden. Digging into her purse, she removed a hair tie, with the intention of putting her hair up. When she did, the clip from her work ID snagged on her thumb, and the ID fell to the floor beside her. A man sitting by himself at a table near them paused from working on his laptop to bend over and pick it up. Handing it to her, he offered a brief smile.
"Thank you,"
Abby said, embarrassed at her clumsiness. Had the man's eyes lingered over her ID a second longer than necessary? She couldn't be sure and chalked it up to being paranoid over the discussion she and Derek were having.
"Remember the pool we have at the shop? No one's guessed right yet, so the pot keeps rolling over," Derek said, continuing in the same vein. "I put my money on him taking a dentist when he gets to D. If I'm right, I'm taking you to Cancun."
"I thought you liked your dentist," she said, taking another sip of her Cosmo.
She set the half-full glass down and pushed it away from her. She hadn't eaten since lunch, and her head was already swimming.
"Duh, my dentist is a man. PK is clearly straight," he joked. "Good thing, because I've been waiting for my dentist to root inside my canal since I laid eyes on him."
She smacked him on the arm, looking around to make sure no one heard his comment.
"I can't take you anywhere." "A girl's got a dream," he said matter-of-factly. "I suppose, but I hope it isn't a dentist. Mine is female and I happen to love her."
"Let's make it a door-to-door salesman then. Everyone hates them."
"Deal,"
she said, reaching across the table to shake hands with him to seal it.
"For once, I don't mind being in an obscure profession, but enough of that. How's the shop doing?"
That got them talking about work, mainly how his new position as head stylist at the hair salon was going. After talking about his oft-dramatic relationship with Charles, as well as Abby's recent breakup with her longtime boyfriend, Derek checked his watch.
"Gotta run. My turn to cook tonight."
"What's for dinner?"
"Homemade carbonara. Trying it the true Italian way, without cream."
"Sounds delicious," Abby said, her eyes aglow. "No man with an apron cooking for me, so I'll settle for Marie Callender and a glass of wine."
After Derek paid the tab, since it was his turn, they made their way outside and stood on the darkened, relatively empty sidewalk. It was almost 7 p.m., and already the early November chill made them both shiver.
"Let me walk you home," he offered.
"I'll be fine. It's 6 blocks.
"I insist,"
Derek said, removing his jacket and draping it over her shoulders. He offered the crook of his arm, then stared straight ahead in the direction of Abby's apartment building. Knowing any further protest would be futile, Abby sighed and took his arm. They walked mostly in silence, listening to the sounds of urbanity along the way. When they reached her building, Derek exchanged nods with the doorman who stood ready to open the door for Abby.
"Thank you, Derek,"
she said, removing her hand from his arm,
"for being such a good friend."
For the first time since she'd left her apartment to meet him, the tightness in her chest was completely gone. Taking his jacket back, he gripped her by the elbows and held them at arm's length.
"Call me if you need anything, and I mean anything. I'm at the shop through Tuesday next week, but I'll push my appointments back if you need me before your prison visit. That weird old bag Mrs. Wilcox will be first on the chopping block. She takes her hair home in a plastic bag because she thinks the CIA tracks people's DNA with it."
Abby stood on her tiptoes and kissed him on the cheek, then turned to walk through the door. Harold exchanged a silent nod with Derek before watching him walk back the way he'd come. Entering her 8th-floor apartment, Abby was immediately met by Thomas Magnum. He curled his body around her leg, his heavy black whiskers brushing her hand as she squatted to pet him. Fixing him dinner first, Abby popped a frozen pot pie in the oven, then clicked on the TV. Wheel of Fortune had just started. Afterward, it wasn't long before she slipped into a luxurious hot bath while sipping an even more luxurious glass of Merlot.